We're going to get started here on our podcast on running virtual appliances in production. Before we get to the content, just a couple logistical ground rules. First of all, this will be recorded. So if you are in some kind of jurisdiction where that is not allowed or that's an issue for you, please be aware of that. On the other hand, most of you aren't going to be talking, so it probably doesn't matter. The second point is that we're going to be having a panel discussion. We'll go until the panelists run out of gas. Depending on how energetic these guys are, that could be a 30 to 45 minutes of discussion. And then we'll go ahead and open it up for questions at the end of the discussion. So with that, there really is no visual content per se. We've got some slides up here, but those are really informational slides just to tell you who our panelists are. So with that, I'm going to introduce the panelists real quickly. We have Matt Richards, who is the Director of Emerging Technology from Novell. We've got Michael Cote, who is an analyst from Redmo. And we've got Simon Bennett, who's a Senior Director of Product Management at Groundwork Open Source. And I'm your moderator, David Dennis, the Senior Director of Marketing and Business Development here at Groundwork. So with that, gentlemen, we'll do a quick little plug here. Matt, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're involved with at Novell?
Sure thing. Good morning, everyone. It's nice to meet you, I suppose, in this scenario. As already suggested, my name is Matt. I'm the Director of Emerging Technology Marketing for Novell. That means for us that I commercialize net new technologies, products, and ecosystems for the company. More specifically, and as it's related to this today, I designed and developed the appliance program with the help of my team here at Novell. And Groundworks, of course, is a fantastic customer of that program. So we're here today to be able to support them and to provide some insight into the appliance form factor and then to the markets and customer problems that it solves for Groundwork.
Great. Thanks, Matt. I'm glad to have you here. And Michael, we'll go ahead and go with you next.
Well, hello, everybody. It's always a pleasure to hang out and talk about something fun and interesting. And as David was saying, I'm Michael Cote, an analyst with Redmonk. And over at Redmonk, we spend a lot of time covering most all aspects of the tech world, if you will, and providing all the research and the findings and the thoughts that we have over at our website for free, redmonk.com. But what's especially interesting here is I do a lot of IT management things and just kind of looking at how people are managing new and old types of infrastructure and everything. And virtual appliances are especially appealing to me as I used to develop software. And as a developer of software, you're always kind of lusting after virtual appliances. So it'll be pretty exciting to talk about them today.
And you've got a weekly show as well. You wanna pimp that?
Sure, yeah. There's a podcast that I do called the IT Management and Cloud Podcast, and it's more or less weekly. I always say you want to shy away from claiming some period of time you're going to deliver, but we just go over news and stuff that's happening in the good old-fashioned IT management world and the cloud world, and you can just go to itmanagementpodcast.com to find that if you're interested.
Great. And lastly, Simon, go for it. Your turn now.
Hi, good morning, everybody. My name is Simon Bennett. I head up the product group over here at Groundwork Open Source. We're an enterprise-enabled monitoring system really designed to enable IT operations and particularly IT operations staff to get really great information and decision-supporting dashboards out of their monitoring systems. As the other guys mentioned, we've made some pretty bold moves into the virtual appliance space with some new product offerings in the last 6 months or so. I'm very excited by that. I've been around systems management and Linux for probably 10 years or so now, and I think we've really got to the point where some of the virtual appliances, both ours and others, are producing really providing great value for people who want to get up and running quickly with a whole range of solutions, including ours, which are monitoring.
Okay, great. Gentlemen, so with that, we'll go ahead and get into it. So again, the topic today for those of you who are just joining us just now is going to be managing and running virtual appliances in production. So this is obviously a case where virtualization has been a hot topic in IT for many years now. One could even say it's not even no longer hot. It's just sort of part of the universe we live in. So if we kind of start off with, I think everybody kind of knows about virtualization, in general. But if we talk about virtual appliances. You know, what are the difference in benefits of virtual appliances as compared to, you know, regular old run-of-the-mill roll-your-own virtualization? So, for example, if somebody says, hey, I have a virtual appliance versus I'm going to go build my own server with my own application stack on it, what are the distinctions here between what's a virtual appliance and what's not? So any one of you guys wants to chime in on that one?
Hey, this is Matt. I'll jump in. Why not? So to get things started, the way I tend to think about virtual appliances versus just virtualization in general is to look at the ease of consumption. As to me, anyone, if a virtual virtualization in a virtual server is akin to a physical server, right, you can take the CDs and you can install the software and go to town the way you always have. The great thing about virtualization, though, is it opens up a whole new host of options for how you might manage and deploy software in your environment. And so in the virtualized environment, the ability to take a single image that's already pre-installed with the operating system, the application and pre-configured to operate in your environment and simply boot it. And that can take you from hours of time installing software to minutes and simply to the time it takes you to copy the image to the new environment and boot it. It's a phenomenal change in how IT management can operate inside the enterprise. And that for us is a huge change. This is one of the reasons we got into the business in the first place.
So you think?
Yeah, and I think that gets to one of the main differences that I see with people. The way virtual appliances end up getting used, where you know, versus virtualization, you're really focusing on managing the application that's running in the appliance versus the infrastructure, if you will. Whereas with usual, with traditional virtualization, I guess it's more of the tasks you're doing are more managing infrastructure and doing everything sort of from the bottom up. Whereas the aspiration, at least, you know, what you hope for with a virtual appliance is that instead of worrying about managing the operating system and you know, doing patching and things like that, that you're more interested in managing the way the application is used. And that's sort of one of the main reasons virtual appliances exist, to kind of get rid of managing the infrastructure. I think it's easy to look at physical appliances, I guess, and you're trying to get kind of the same sorts of things where you're just plugging in an Ethernet cable and some power and things like that, and you're not having to worry about setting up servers so much and doing everything else that you traditionally would with an application that you're managing.
Great. So, Simon, these guys covered a lot of ground. Do you have anything to add to what they said?
No, I completely agree. I think reducing the time it takes to get a particular application up and running is the name of the game here. And, you know, I think we all recognize that the infrastructure setup pieces, you know, whether it's plugging cables, shuffling CDs, trying to get boot servers in the right place to bring up new hardware is kind of low value when all you want to do is get a new application into production.
Great. Okay. And so so with that, if we talk about, you guys, I mean, Michael specifically mentioned the focus on applications. What do you guys think are the types of applications that are a good candidates or are most popular for virtual appliances, and maybe some that aren't?
Well, you know what? It'll actually be interesting to hear what Matt says as far as the market player, the directory that they have listed there. But, you know, what I notice is open source applications are very popular. I come across them frequently in virtual appliances, and I think that's due to sort of the licensing is a little easier and things like that. But what I also think of as being a really good fit for a virtual appliance is I'm kind of jokingly putting it this way, but basically enterprise software, just software that's very complex and has a couple of moving parts and generally takes a while to get set up and running. And, you know, it gets back to this notion of the reason you're using a virtual appliance is to make getting up and running, bootstrapping a lot easier, is an easier sort of thing. And if you think about a lot of applications that exist out there, you know, they do a lot of important complex things and so forth and so on. And consequently, they usually take a little while to install and set up. And hopefully, when you're using a virtual appliance, it sort of comes ready to use out of that. And so those are the kind of applications, you know, I was joking about when you're an application developer, you kind of have this lust after a virtual appliance, because you realize that you can skip a lot of that install and configuration time that's a big hassle up front. So those are the sorts of things that I get interested in seeing in a virtual appliance form. And just as another thing, it's not really a type of application, but something that virtual appliances enable that are interesting as far as applications is, it really makes the ability to try out and trial an application a lot easier, because you don't really have to commit to setting it up, even if you don't have to spend all that time setting something up that you may end up not liking or using, which I've seen people respond to pretty well, just to like kind of kick the tires, as it were, of an application.
Yeah, I think, you know, aside from the actual physical form factor, Michael, one of the things I've noticed is, you know, aside from the delivering a virtual appliance product, there's a certain mindset that goes along with that, which is, you know, useful to us as an ISV to think about, you know, what are the other little tweaks, you know, the setting up this firewall rule or this particular syslog configuration, and thinking about it from a virtual appliance mindset just encompasses a lot more of the things that our end users, you know, the administrators that were charged with setting these things up have to deal with. And I think that results in a higher quality experience overall, because we're taking those things into account from the get-go, when they're kind of easy to overlook sometimes when it's not, you know, core to the functionality you're providing in your app.
Yeah, and just to build on some of these comments, absolutely open source. We're seeing a lot of open source applications as appliances, and I think that that says a lot about the nature of open source software, and in many ways, the forward-looking nature of and their ability to respond quickly based on their community involvement to these new and emerging trends like cloud computing, like virtualization. So, absolutely agree on that. Check. The way I tend to think about this one, it starts really at the idea of the virtual piece. So if you're looking at a virtual appliance, it's, you know, first, what workloads are virtualizable and what aren't? So there are some workloads with high CPU needs or with high memory requirements or maybe a lot of disk access that just don't make sense as appliances. As virtual appliances. And that's partly because they don't make sense as a virtualized workload. So if you sort of get those out of the way and you look at those things that would work in a virtualized environment, then we see everything across the gambit from middleware appliances, right? Somebody might make a database appliance that you can grab, whether that's a proprietary database or an open source database. We're seeing both. We're seeing email servers and things like that are core business process based. And so we're seeing that across the range. And we're seeing spam filters, utilities, other workloads that might have once been thought of as strictly a hardware appliance. We're now seeing the hardware appliance vendors saying, well, wait a minute, why do I have to be dependent on hardware? What if I could just give you a virtual appliance and the same basic business I'm in today in a new form factor? Wouldn't that be great? What does that open up for me? And the last element I'll say, to not confuse things too badly, is it has a lot to do, too, with the customer size and the target market for the software itself. Small and medium business, of course, have the simplicity in mind when they're looking to buy software. And that, you see a lot of resonation there on virtual appliances at that end of the spectrum, or even hardware appliances at that end of the spectrum. And then on the enterprise side, to a lesser extent, the same, you'll also see it resonate for the simplicity reasons, but you won't see necessarily an SAP ERP implementation at a large bank on a virtual appliance. It just doesn't make sense. So that's really how we, at least that's my experience with the market.
No, I think it's an interesting approach. So you would tend to think of things like in a large data warehousing applications, for example. It's not necessarily a great candidate for virtualization appliance or otherwise, for example.
Yeah, precisely, but primarily because they're not so good for virtualization in general, because virtualization doesn't necessarily offer up that acceleration. Now, having said that, there are things you can do, and the hypervisors are all getting better at being able to support virtual appliances with higher data throughput, with high CPU requirements. So it's changing every day, but today, that's a pretty true statement.
So I guess the last question, kind of taking on something that Michael said. So Simon, you know, Groundwork Open Source offers a virtual appliance. In fact, it's a SLES, a SUSE-powered virtual appliance that we've made in collaboration with Novell. And it has inside of it what I would characterize as a pretty complex enterprise software stack. What would you say the benefits are to the customer of using the SUSE-powered virtual appliance as opposed to, you know, the downloadable install-it-yourself kind of binaries?
There's a couple of things that have been, you know, surprising to me, you know, since we rolled out the virtual appliance. Obviously, you know, all of the benefits we talked about so far in terms of, you know, just being able to download an image and fire it up and really be up and running in, you know, 15 or 20 minutes is very realistic, and we've seen a lot of customers do that with the SLES Lab powered virtual appliance. One of the effects that we've seen which I wasn't expecting, was a lot of the questions that we were fielding in kind of pre-sales about, you know, how do I size this monitoring system? How far does it scale? We've seen a lot less of those since we've been delivering the virtual appliance because people can go try it for themselves. You know, to Michael's comment, they can go kick the tires on, you know, a system they have lying around, you know, maybe a VMware workstation or a little ESX installation they've got. And, you know, once they're ready to push the limits a little bit, you know, run a full monitoring auto discovery, do some more advanced things and scale the environment out by virtue of the sort of virtualized underpinnings, they can simply move the hardware slider to add some more CPUs, a bunch more RAM, and they have a much more capable box, which simply doesn't happen, you know, in the installable software world, or even in the physical appliance world. Obviously, you know, giving the machine a massive in-field upgrade is much harder to do when you're dealing with, you know, physical stuff. So that was a pretty remarkable change in how we were seeing people adopting Groundwork Monitor in the virtual appliance form factor.
Great. That's a good wrap-up. Okay, so
I have a question to follow up on that one. That was a very interesting question. What would it take to install, just a, you know, on average, a Groundworks before a virtual appliance and after? If it's 20 minutes after to get it up and running, is it an hour before, or just curious?
I would say there's probably... you know, our installable software includes all of the pieces that you need in terms of MySQL Enterprise database, you know, all of the middleware pieces and the application. So in terms of the actual installation part, I would say it's probably, you know, saves half of the time. I think the real time-saving part from a administrator's point of view is actually at the level below that. So doing things like making sure the Linux OS configuration meets the guidelines that are recommended for our application, making sure the network devices are set up, making sure time syncing is all set up, is all taken care of. Now, individually, those are all 5-10 minute tasks, but you're probably looking at, you know, an additional half an hour just to get the prerequisites done.
Excellent. Thank you.
The last thing I'll get out of moderator mode and just interject on there. I think the other thing that we're seeing also on that, Matt, is that the fact that it's a self-contained virtual appliance that has Linux already installed inside of it means that people who aren't very familiar with Linux can use it right away. And that's less true of the installable binary.
Got it. Yeah, and that's very much what we're seeing with our customers and participants in the SUSE appliance program. So I just wanted to ask you what you guys were seeing from a real benefit, because that's for those folks listening, certainly a benefit to being able to pick it up as an appliance and a little more data on why in a virtual appliance versus not.
That is an interesting phenomena, whether it's virtualization in general, but virtual appliances or images and to put it in the extreme way that the operating system doesn't matter. I mean, obviously that's just a hyperbolic way of putting it, but it does sort of give you a lot more flexibility as far as platforms or operating systems that you're used to, and it's an interesting thing you wouldn't really have thought a few years ago, that you kind of, you know, you're still concerned when you're running something in production what the full stack is and so forth and so on, but it's a lot easier if you're a Windows person or a Linux person or a Unix person or whatever type of person you self-identify with to kind of just go along with whatever operating system is supporting some application that you're using. So there's a nice expansive thing that goes on there where, as an application developer, you still need to be concerned about operating systems, but you definitely have a lot more latitude. And it's nice as a user of those applications, because then you know, in the old days, as it were, you would see what operating system something ran on, and if you weren't familiar with it or didn't like it, you would just sort of give up and stop being interested. But now you don't necessarily have to do that.
And I know it's not fair now because the audience can't answer, but I throw out to the audience when it is time for Q&A, to bring up the question of, you know, does the OS matter to you for something like what we're talking about today? And if it does or it doesn't, I'd like to hear your opinion.
Ooh, okay, challenge to the audience there. So go ahead and enter your responses to that in the chat session, and when we get to the Q&A portion at the end, we'll go ahead and tackle that. So the gauntlet has been thrown down. So Michael, since you mentioned the word production, you know, people use, you know, virtualization and virtual appliances in test, dev, and QA environments for, you know, quite some time, and it's been a well accepted there. But we still see a little bit of fud sometimes, at least on our side, with the use of virtualization in production, at least in some places. So, you know, for all of you, you know, when somebody says, okay, I'm now going to make the transition and start using virtualization and virtual appliances a lot more in a production environment, you know, now they start caring a lot more about things like performance, uptime, reliability, availability, all the things that you would associate with a regular production server. So, you know, what are the differences, or if any, between monitoring and managing virtual appliances in a production environment as contrasted to a traditional non-virtualized you know, server, and you know, what are the kind of tools that people should be looking at to tackle that?
Well, I think the concerns you end up having are essentially similar, if not, I don't know if it's a subset or superset, but they're similar to concerns of, you know, when you're managing a virtual appliance in production, concerns you have of managing virtualization in production. And a lot of those tend to get down to, well, I mean, first, I'll state the obvious thing. You need to have programmatic access to the infrastructure, to the thing you're managing. I mean, you know, if you only have sort of, if you don't have any access to an application you're running into a virtual appliance to sort of look at and monitor and manipulate, if you will, in the same way that you would, you know, the equivalent of SSHing in or more advanced, you know, APIs and ways of doing things. I mean, you need some sort of access like that that plugs into your tool chain. And so it's good to, like, look at the appliances that you have and make sure that they're not an island, if you will. Because eventually, you know, everything needs to be managed eventually, I guess. And I think the other main area, and, you know, both Simon and Matt were kind of getting into this, you know, there is a certain amount, there's usually a lot of networking setup that you have to do relative to other things that you have to do. And just in a virtualized world, you are concerned a little bit more with network setup and configuration. Essentially, what you're concerned with is managing the relationship between the physical, you know, the physical network or physical storage and the virtual that you have. And the tools that I see that are interesting out there for doing this, I mean, they really do focus on, they don't necessarily always cross over into that wall. I mean, they will cross over into the virtual world, but it's sort of more traditional stuff. Once you're on the physical side of the virtual world, the management is what management has always been. But the new element is really managing that relationship between the two. As an example, you know, and whether it's in a virtual appliance or a virtualized anything, there might be some sort of virtual degradation, like your storage might be a little wacky or something. And when you're troubleshooting what's going on there, you need some way to link that back to the physical storage that you have to troubleshoot a drive that might be bad or something like that. And that's, you know, that's just a cheesy example, but that is the kind of challenge that comes up when you're managing something that's virtual, whether it's an appliance or not. And since it's through an appliance, I mean, part of the, when I kind of look at virtual appliances, the main thing that I'm interested in is, you know, what are you going to be doing with the appliance like 6 months out when you need to update it? And like, how is the virtual appliance and the management software hopefully included in it, helping you manage updates and patches and things like that? And those are the kind of things that you need when you're evaluating running a virtual appliance in production or probably even non-critical production things. Just think about what are you going to do in 6 months? Like, what are the tasks that you're going to do? And for the most part, the whole point of commercial virtual appliance offerings is that they do all of this stuff, but it's good just to make sure, to kind of theorize what you'll have to be managing. And it typically is kind of the same sorts of things. The idea is just that it's going to be a little easier and quicker than managing something that's physical.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. I think that, you know, you hit on a really key point there. A lot of the things that happen in enterprise production environments don't go away. You know, you still have a security policy you need to comply with. There's still, you know, log file compliance and archiving things. You know, all of those kind of things still need to be accounted for, whether you're talking about a virtual appliance or not. And I thought your insight into, you know, this appliance had better be open as opposed to a closed appliance, you know, where you can't get SSH, SNMP, shell, whatever kind of access to, you know, these kind of environments is kind of limited to the places where that doesn't matter, you know, which tends to be the smaller SMB type applications. And, you know, you're really going to struggle in an enterprise environment without taking that into account. I thought the other comment you made about, you know, dealing with contention, whether it's storage, CPU, or I/O, is really an important part of, you know, managing and monitoring a virtualized environment independent of whether we're talking about appliances or anything else. You know, certainly keeping track of things like how much I/O is getting stolen from, you know, one system to another is still pretty challenging, particularly in a mixed virtualization environment. And you know, those challenges don't go away, you know, with a virtual appliance. In fact, in some ways, you know a little bit less about what's going on in the environment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're getting at some of the benefits of, you know, it's always good to follow up with. If it's just all the same old stuff, why am I bothering the new stuff? With sort of a qualification there. But, you know, you're getting at some of the advantages, I mean, of virtualization, whether it's an appliance or regular virtualization. And I think that you really do have a lot more levers you can pull and buttons you can press to manage the applications and infrastructure you have. And as you were saying earlier, you know, you can up the amount of memory that something has or give it more processing speed. And essentially you can upgrade the infrastructure an application is running on. And that on its own is a tremendous, you know, innovation on top of, you know, we've got to spend 2 weeks migrating to bigger servers, which, you know, I've lived through many of those on intranets and otherwise, and they rarely ever go very well. And the hope with virtualization is that those levers that you have are a lot easier to use. So you're given more ability to manage something if it's virtualized, which is always, you know, an interesting sort of, I guess, dichotomy of management software. It's like, on the one hand, its goal is to simplify, and then also, but as a consequence, it usually gives you a lot more little levers to play around with to do more management. And I think that's sort of one of the major long-term advantages of virtualization that you see is just a better ability to manage things because you sort of got that layer of virtualization underneath everything where you actually have control.
And I just from our perspective, we're actually having very similar conversations with our customers to what you're alluding to here in virtualization management and virtual appliances, which are, as an enterprise, as you suggested, small, medium business, okay, I might take what I get. On the other side, the virtual appliance is something that arrives, and it may or may not comply to standards. So I need to be able to add, as you suggest, the open appliance is a particularly good way to describe open versus closed appliances, and I might want to add what we call intelligence here at Novell, which is to say, depending on the workload, there might be an identity and access management piece that you want to add. There might be a log management hook and reporting and data stream you need to be able to capture. There might be some compliance elements you need to capture. And all of that is something you may want to be able to add to any virtual appliance in your environment. So when it arrives, there still may be that additional setup for sure. And that's where some of the tooling comes in that makes that ultra easy. Where you can simply look at it, add a couple of extra packages, and at the other end comes that standard, now to your standard in the enterprise level appliance and form factor. So certainly seeing some of the same elements from the Novell side as well.
So let me ask you this. You guys have talked about the wonderful world of sizing and performance that we get into where the virtualized application is decoupled from the underlying hardware in such a way that you can scale the hardware up and down as you see fit and thus avoid the kind of painful migrations that Michael was talking about. And I think everybody agrees that's a groovy and wonderful thing. But what about the lifecycle management of the appliance? You've got this virtual appliance. I think the implication through most of this call is that the virtual appliance came from an ISV, so you didn't create it yourself. You got it from somebody like Groundwork or somebody else who makes virtual appliances available. And like anything else that's running in production environment, from time to time has to be patched and upgraded and things like that. You know, what are the techniques involved with that? Is it better or worse than doing it on a regular server? You know, what are some of the differences? You know, just take a stab at that, because I think a lot of the things that people are used to doing on a conventional server can be quite a bit different when they're dealing with a virtual appliance, especially an ISV supplied one.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of aspects to this. You know, certainly one of the things that we found from, you know, working with Novell is there is a set of existing tools and processes and best practices that have carried over from kind of the traditional installable, you know, Linux OS business and you know, very much applicable in the appliance context. So, you know, keeping your system up to date with the security fixes and updates and all of that kind of, you know, basic platform level patching is something that, you know, frankly, we don't have the expertise or time to be doing, and it's great to be able to go to Novell and say, you know, what is the best practice for dealing with these kinds of things. It also makes our development much more efficient because we can be working from the latest and greatest version at all times. So making sure that we're keeping up with the latest, point releases on SLES 11 is something that our customers care about greatly. So, you know, having all of that built in, not just to the appliance, but into our development methodology and our process automatically is tremendously useful. From the application, I'm sorry. From the application perspective, obviously there's kind of a standard packaging approaches and standard layouts, you know, which, you know, as long as you're careful from a software development point of view to pay attention to those, you can take advantage of those same, patch and update mechanisms to take care of the application itself. And, you know, there's a huge amount of heavy lifting that goes on under the covers on the part of, you know, the software engineering that Novell has done in this case to make all that packaging, you know, work well, deal with all those corner cases and all the architecture related issues and really make it, feasible to do automatic in-place upgrades or notification of updates or, you know, really make it seamless, and easy to manage from an end user point of view, you know, avoiding them having to do things like, you know, be a Linux expert or, you know, a particular Linux distribution expert, which can sometimes be even harder.
And this is Matt. That's an excellent sort of place for me to jump in, which is that was our design point for the SUSE Appliance program as a whole, and then very specifically the SUSE Studio, which is the build tool, and then the Lifecycle Management Server, which is the patch and update tool you've alluded to here, which does provide that facility. And the idea, to be very simple about it, is you've built an appliance, that's great, now it has to be patched. There's a bunch of ways you can choose to patch it, and through our tool, you can provide those patches out, and as an enterprise customer, receive those patches, receive the upgrades, and that can all be managed by Groundwork in such a way that the Groundwork doesn't even really have to think about the process. It's all encapsulated in the tool, and they don't have to think, you guys don't have to think about the operating system. It's all encapsulated in the tool, and you don't have to think about entitlements either, right? If they're entitled, check yes on the management console. If they're not entitled, then they don't get the patches and updates. So a lot of tooling and elements behind the scenes that we're trying to make creating and then consuming this form factor as easy as possible for both Groundwork and our partners and then also for the enterprise.
So let me ask you guys a kind of a best practice question around that. Since it's so easy to move things around with virtual appliances, and this there may not be a clear-cut answer to this, but I'll answer it either way. It seems like you've got a virtual appliance, you've got two options. One, you can use a lifecycle management server, a patching mechanism from the ISV or a combination of both, which is what happens in Groundwork's case, to in essence upgrade the appliance that's already there. The other option would be you could sort of do the parallel migration thing where you download the latest appliance from the ISV, you know, and it's already up to date, and you migrate whatever data that was in the old appliance to the new appliance. Which one do you think is better?
Well, I'll even make it more complicated, but
okay.
In a second, but it depends on the scenario. There's also a flip-flop scenario where you do a little bit of both. Right? You have really two images running in the appliance, one that's your primary and one's your backup, and you do all your patching and updating to the backup, or you then switch to that as your primary and then patch.
Okay, yeah.
You do a little bit of both, and from my perspective, that tends to be where folks like to go is to have the two partitions and then data is separated out in a separate image. So, of course, you don't lose that data when you do the patching and updating. And that tends to be how I would see, or how we tend to see our customers doing it. Not all, but many.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely seems like an interesting way of doing things. I mean, I mean, honestly, I think it just depends on the application that you have and what its tolerance is for those different scenarios and what works out best. I mean, sometimes just converting all the data that you have in configuration is an easy task, and sometimes that's not easy, and that's the nice thing about something like a virtual appliance is hopefully that the ISV or the person providing it handles all that stuff, and you only see the positive effects of it rather than having to worry about managing it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, from a, you know, ISV perspective, you know, we want to be able to offer either or both of those things, and we don't usually know ahead of time which one is best. You know, having done a big, you know, user interface revamp, JBoss portal implementation, and added a whole ton of new features in our release 6 version of Groundwork Monitor, you know, that was clearly a case where we would, you know, definitely have a preference towards kind of a parallel migrate data approach. But that's overkill for some releases. So, you know, being able to pick either or both of those options depending on what's going to be easiest for the end customer, and, you know, being able to do that relatively late in the game is pretty important.
Great. Okay, gentlemen, so last topic now, the cloud. So one of the purported benefits of virtual appliances is that they're easier to move in and out of the cloud. So you can have your virtual infrastructure that's behind your own firewall that's running your virtual appliances. And then, you know, at a time and place that you're choosing, you can, at least in theory, migrate those to the cloud. And potentially you could even move them back and forth if you wanted to. A, is that a good idea? Is it realistic? People certainly talk about it being a possibility, but does it even make sense? And second of all, you know, what are some of the tools and methodologies for approaching the back and forth and to and from the cloud kind of scenario?
That's a big question. I'll start quickly from the Novell side. We certainly, there's actually an element, of course, to make life a little more complicated that I'd add at the end. But from a virtual appliance standpoint, first, being able to move it in and out of the cloud gets a little complex because, of course, every cloud has a format, right? So Amazon EC2 is its AMI format. The exception to this is if you can find a cloud provider like maybe Telefonica that is a VMware, you know, vSphere environment, and your enterprise virtualization preference is vSphere, then moving things in and out of the cloud is actually fairly straightforward. Theoretically, the open virtualization format in its version 3, so there's 3 different levels of it. Today, it hasn't gotten near this, but in the future, theoretically, there'll be this open virtualization format that can be consumed by any hypervisor, but that's not the world we live in today. So the real ability to migrate back and forth is based on the format of the virtual environment to begin with. And
that's sort of what I end up seeing is that a lot of this notion of sliding between the cloud and the on-premise thing is there's ways to sort of customize it and kind of do things here and there at the moment, but it is sort of in development and aspirational at the moment, just because the standardization that you even see across operating systems doesn't really, like Matt's getting to, exist in the cloud area. And, you know, the thing that I do see as more interesting is figuring out, as more interesting in the here and now and practical, is figuring out how to use cloud resources as various parts of services for your system. So, you know, you hear a lot of people using cloud storage to back up, whether it's databases or data that they have, and doing things like that. And I think that's the more mainstream, pragmatic thing that's happening at the moment. But definitely, like, you can see the sort of roadmap in your head of, like, we're organizing all of our applications in a virtual appliance or virtualization, but we're packaging things up such that they would be easier than they were if they were physical environments to move to another, to move to a cloud-based thing if that works out and we happen to want that in the future.
You know, and it actually is very much worth pointing out which kind of cloud, right? A public cloud. Like
public or private, yeah.
Well, but even then in the middle you have the virtual privates, which will fence off some of the public with some encryption and some IP address translation and things like that. So it feels like it's your own, but it's still a public cloud. But it's more like a VPN equivalent of the network. A VPN is to a network as virtual private clouds are to public clouds. And then you have the private clouds hosted and then the private clouds internal. Clearly, if it's a private cloud, you can control the format, and a lot of that migration is a little bit simpler. But in the case of, as we've been talking about here, the public clouds, yeah, it's not so much. Now, the one element that I'm seeing appliances and virtual appliances in particular really pick up is around the security piece of it. So one of the reasons some state why they don't adopt public cloud or even virtual private cloud environments for mainstream workloads, as we just suggested, is that they're not secure. So there's a couple ways you can handle that, and one of those is the cloud security, some of the cloud security identity and access management stuff we've been doing here at Novell, but more specifically to this conversation, the use of a virtual appliance locally in conjunction with a cloud. So you keep the stuff that's actually imperative and somewhat delicate and sensitive data for your business in a virtual appliance locally, and then you use the rest of the workload itself, the raw horsepower, which may just be streaming data that is meaningless if someone were to compromise it, but it's the raw horsepower you need in the cloud. You do that in the cloud, and you might use a public cloud in that case while using an appliance locally to store that data. So the conjunction of the two actually tends to make using the cloud even more secure from an end-user standpoint. So that's a net new area that I've seen picking up lately.
So one kind of tactical question about that. So, and this is actually for my own edification. I know that things like SUSE Studio, for example, when you're making a virtual appliance, you have a choice of formats. You can have an AMI, a VMDK, et cetera. If a virtual appliance does already exist, and let's say it's in a VMDK and it's running on a VMware ESX, and you want to then convert it to an AMI so that you can then put it up in the Amazon EC2 environment, are there any tools that exist that you can do that with an already existing, you know, appliance you're using as opposed to making one from scratch?
There's a suite of tools in our PlateSpin product at Novell, not to make this a Novell ad, but there are tools like our PlateSpin tools at Novell that will take an image format and translate it into a different format.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So you can take a virtual image format and translate it into a different one. Now, the challenge, of course, is which cloud formats are supported, which becomes the issue there. So it's not any cloud to any cloud, because each cloud implements things slightly differently. So AMI and Grid and Rackspace, they're all different, right? So it's not any cloud to any cloud.
Got it.
So the vision, though, is that you'd point your PlateSpin tool or whatever tool you happen to have at a virtual appliance that was running, call it a workload, for lack of a better word. You point your tool at a workload, it pulls it off the server and translates it into whatever the format is in the target environment and then passes it over. And that's actually where we're going.
Great. Simon, anything to add? Because otherwise we're approaching our Q&A section now.
Well, I think, Michael mentioned, from my perspective, one of the most important things, which is, the technology is still got a little ways to go. Doing things like, migrating from a private VMware, virtualized environment running an appliance to, one of the public cloud offerings. At least today, undercuts a little bit of the value of a virtual appliance. As an example, we spent a pretty good amount of time making sure our virtual appliance was tuned in such a way that it performed well in that particular environment. It still works if you migrate it to an Amazon-like public cloud, but you're kind of getting under the covers a little bit until there's a little bit more standardization in terms of auxiliary tools, APIs, network configuration. It's still a little bit of the Wild West out there in terms of not just making that work, but making it work in a way that's, going to give you a consistent level of performance. I think the good news is it's getting a lot better very rapidly. I think there's a whole host of people who have similar problems, both end customers, software providers, even service providers who are providing some of these platforms. So I think, the outlook is good. We're just not quite there yet.
So bottom line, you're saying possible, but you might be on the bleeding edge a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it. Okay, so
I think that's absolutely true.
Okay, so with that, we got some questions piling up. So what we're going to do now is we're going to transition to the Q&A portion of the call at this point. So go ahead and type your questions into the chat window. Either one, you can either put it in the Q&A chat window or the regular chat window. I see questions piling up in both. We'll go ahead and tackle some of those. I'm going to read them off here. Okay, and any one of you guys who wants to jump in on these, feel free to do so. So the first question, how do you handle disaster recovery or continuity with a virtual appliance? Using a cloud is not an option for my company at this time due to security concerns. So in essence, how would you handle disaster recovery and continuity with a virtual appliance where they're not using a cloud?
Well, that's a
big I'll just start out with some practices that I see, and maybe you guys can comment on things that are specific to each of y'all's knowledge pool. But I'm kind of generalizing the virtualization, but there is, depending on the virtualization technology you have, there's certain disaster recovery and things like that built into it. But speaking very generally, the idea, the thing that's helpful about virtualization is, in theory, it's easier to sort of have a snapshot and backups and kind of always be monitoring what the current state of your system is, if you will. And then depending on the tool choices that you have, you know, if you're using these various sorts of backing up tools, I mean, you kind of have to reorient your mind that you're doing a backup of a running application, essentially. And once you kind of have that mindset, then you can look around for sort of tools and processes where you could take that backup of a running process and boot it up essentially somewhere else if you need to recover from something or something along there. And of course, when you're doing disaster recovery, you're worrying about a geographic location of the physical servers that you're running things on. So if you're not using a cloud-based thing, you're going to need some sort of geographically dispersed backup infrastructure, if you will, dispersed from the thing that failed.
And I actually, to build, I think, on that, when I think about disaster recovery of an appliance, in many ways it's a little bit easier as long as you have the image stored somewhere, right? And then in terms of backing up the OS and the configuration and what's going on at that level, and then the application itself. Now, state data, which really comes down to data, is something that becomes the issue to me. So you can boot up the same appliance somewhere else around the world out of a software library somewhere, and bring it up and running with the right application very quickly. The question is, to your point a minute ago, the data. And there are many virtual appliance or virtualization-based disaster recovery solutions that can get that data synchronized in an off-site location for you. And in my mind, you'd be using whatever you're using in your virtual environment today to track and store data. It's really not that different in this case. It may require a little additional configuration.
Mm-hmm.
But that's I think, how you'd handle it.
Yeah, just to add some, specific examples onto that, you know, I know Michael didn't really want to name some technologies, but, you know, certainly among people who are using Groundwork Monitor in their environments and, you know, need HA-like capabilities just to maintain service levels, you know, obviously monitoring system is pretty key to operations once you get it rolled out. You know, features like vMotion, to take the VMware example, are a reasonably cost-effective way to attain some of those availability goals. There's certainly some implementation challenges in terms of making sure it's geographically distributed, but from an operations point of view, or having that capability baked into the virtualization layer makes a whole bunch of sense. Certainly Groundwork has offered, you know, an application level standby server for a very long time. But in a practical environment where you have a ton of different applications, a monitoring system, a ticketing system, a messaging exchange system, a SharePoint, and all the other things, you know, all of those application level failover and HA solutions all work a little bit differently. So if you're able to somehow standardize on a single approach, it just makes disaster planning so much easier. Because the applications behave in a consistent way, you can plan it ahead of time. It's much easier to test those kind of approaches if they're baked in at the OS level instead of kind of each application does it a little bit differently.
So to summarize, it sounds like you guys are saying there's almost three different layers at which you can tackle, and maybe more. One is the OS level, so you could do file level duplication from one virtual appliance to another image, maybe using something like rsync. The other would be use a tool that's part of the virtualization infrastructure, such as vMotion. And the third would be that the application itself has some kind of failover, standby, or other kind of a backup functionality built into itself. Would that be fair enough?
I think so.
I think that's a fair statement, yeah.
All right. Yeah, I'm good at the Reader's Digest thing. You guys have all the details. I've got the, you know, how to fit it under a 3x5 card talent. Okay, next question here. Can use of virtual appliances inside an enterprise's private cloud be of value? If so, what might be some great examples of this type of usage?
Well, my first answer to the private cloud is absolutely. If you think of this virtual appliance that you've built as a complete stack with essentially what it needs to run in it, so it's got an OS, it's got middleware in it, and it's got an application in it, and it's all pre-configured and it works, and it's running in your private cloud, you have all sorts of fantastic opportunities then to move it, for example, where you need, right? So vMotion or something like that, which can be done with a virtualization anyway, but the virtual appliance also makes it, if you have multiple workloads that are exactly the same running in your private cloud, so you can then patch and manage those multiple appliances as if they were one. So that's also extremely helpful on patch and management time and time to maintain the appliance itself. So to me, the you can also cloud burst out if you need to a different physical server, right? But also to maybe a third party if you have an MSP or somebody that you've contracted out. When you run out of capacity on your internal cloud, you might be able to take a private external cloud and cloud burst out to it and then come back. So there are all sorts of elements that are enabled for a virtual appliance in a private cloud that I think exemplify a lot of the things we've been talking about today. You gain all the value of the appliance, and you have a lot of the management infrastructure of a cloud already in place internally. I think that's a pretty win-win scenario for you.
Yeah, in fact, with one of the ideas of what a private cloud is, I mean, you're as the IT staff, I guess, are essentially becoming brokers for a bunch of virtual appliances that either you got off the shelf, so to speak, to really get deep into a weird metaphor into physical software, or that you've made yourself. And so, I mean, I think the idea of a virtual appliance and sort of a ready-made, your own, whether you buy that virtual appliance from, or you get that virtual appliance from someone else, or you're crafting it on your own, I mean, is a pretty big part of what a self-service private cloud is all about. So, I mean, I think it definitely plays a part in private clouds for sure. And you know, one of the more interesting things that you see in this sort of self-service vision of what a private cloud is the idea that you have a catalog of virtual appliances, essentially, that business users or end users or whoever IT is supporting, they come along and they just kind of pick the virtual appliance they want to have running and set up. And, you know, they're not really called virtual appliances necessarily, but if you think about it, they're pretty much the same thing. So it seems like virtual appliances and private clouds would play pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other area which is specific to monitoring, which is pretty exciting, is, you know, the whole idea that you can have a virtual private cloud, which is basically virtualizing the network layer and the interconnects, means that some of the traditional monitoring things that we do, like automatic discovery of all the things that are sitting on the network and, you know, configuring good level of application monitoring once we find stuff, start to work again. You know, in a pure public cloud environment, most of that stuff doesn't work just from a security point of view. But if you're talking about a virtual private cloud with a virtual private network, you know, I'm thinking in particular of things like the Amazon VPC offering, all that stuff works really well and is a good way to migrate a whole bunch of legacy applications in addition to sort of the appliance-based applications, which are probably going to coexist for quite a while.
So it sounds like you guys are saying that, you know, any application or / virtual appliance, you know, variant thereof, for which the ability to tweak it in terms of the number of instances you've got, the number of computing resources you want to assign to it, and possibly, you know, where it appears on the network, is going to be a good candidate to use inside a enterprise's private cloud. Is that fair enough?
That's a good Reader's Digest edition.
That's a good Reader's Digest edition? Okay. Okay, with that, well, we're coming for the top of the hour here. And kind of the last question we've got here from the audience regards how do I performance tune things and measure performance of virtual appliances in a cloud, either public or private?
Well, that answer could go on and on forever. I mean, I'll just make a call back to something we were talking about earlier, and I mean, fundamentally, you need to be able to access, you need those sort of open appliances like we were talking about, and being able to access things, and you know, if you're responsible for something and it's a black box, I mean, obviously that's sort of the least desirable state. So when you're looking at virtual appliances, you know, you want to make sure that you can, there's basically APIs and just ways to access them. And the more, in general, the more programmatic and the more open they are, you know, the better off you'll be in the situation that this question is asking. I mean, you know, but on the other hand, you do have to realize that, you know, you don't want to take that openness and remove all the benefits that you have, so you're customizing your virtual appliance, and now you have all the traditional problems that you had with physical things. But, yeah, I mean, absolutely. You need to expect, whether you're on a public-private cloud or physical hybrid things or whatever wacky setup that you have, that if you can't access the thing you're managing, then you're really not going to be happy.
Yeah, and just from a monitoring best practice perspective, you know, we generally recommend that people don't start out at that low level kind of virtualization, you know, CPU stealing, IO throughput kind of level, but start at the application level, you know. So if it's a web application, send some, you know, synthetic transactions to the web app that do the common actions on your app. If it's a messaging system, send some test messages through and measure at that level, and use that to kind of guide your performance tuning efforts rather than kind of trying to boil up from the bottom what is, you know, typically once you peel back all the layers, a pretty complex enterprise application.
Yeah, you're starting to get into an area we call business service management, which becomes rather complex, and you have to ask the questions about at what level do you want to know the performance. And certainly, right. I think that example is the business service level, right? But then underneath that, there's, well, what are the components, i.e. the virtual appliances that string together to make that workload happen? And then given that, what specifically are the, you know, the hardware and virtual appliance and virtualization layer, and then, of course, app and data level layer issues that might interrupt that service. And that whole connective process uses something called a CMDB and comes under the title of business service management. Again, stuff that we do outside of this context at Novell, but also things you'll see in the market under the guise of BSM, business service management.
Oh, my God, you threw down the CMDB gauntlet. Now, that's a whole other top podcast in and of itself.
I know. That's why I thought that. But at least it was the last question.
No, and you know, I mean, just to add to that, I mean, I think there, it really is, it's interesting to see the ideas of application performance management and transactions and all this BSM or IT service management. The words that I see people using when they're managing virtualized resources or cloud things, they're not the same words as all of that, but you can kind of pick out the same sort of tasks that they're in. And I think Simon was getting to something that I see it kind of across the board with people who are managing these kind of more dynamic environments and people who are providing the tools to manage them. And that's that instead of being worried about every single little thing, you know, every fan speed and every disk thing all the time, they only worry about those things when they're diagnosing something. And instead, what they tend to start focusing on are looking at things as aggregate, looking at the sort of the applications themselves and the transactions running through it. And that is kind of part of the hope of having a more dynamic virtual whatever infrastructure, is that you're much more concerned with the application, but you have all of that knowledge of what could be going wrong underneath, but you don't have to spend your time freaking out about memory usage and CPU all the time. Instead, you can focus on the actual thing being delivered, if you will.
Yeah, and that's the key is at the dashboard level, which is where BSM starts, is what are the processes or things that you care about most.
Great. Well, I think, gentlemen, that's a good wrap-up, which is, you know, in essence, you know, when you get down to pay attention when it matters to the business, I guess, bottom line. Okay, so we're at the top of the hour. We need to wrap this baby up at this point. Just kind of a little closing comments for those of you who joined late or only perhaps were able to listen to part of the podcast. We will be converting this when we're done here to a downloadable podcast format, also streamable. And it'll take us a couple hours after we're done here, so give us a little bit of time in order to get the recording transcoded. But when it's all done, if you want more information, including the downloadable podcast, if you want to check out the SUSE-powered Gronk Modern Enterprise Virtual Appliance, and also some white papers and other educational materials, you can go to www.gwos.com/panel podcast. That's all one word, panel podcast. And if you're interested in learning about Novell's SUSE Studio, check out www.susestudio.com.
So again, thanks everybody for attending. And if you are we're only able to hear part of this, well, as soon as the podcast is done being transcoded, we'll also send out a reminder email to all of the registrants inviting you to get a copy. And of course, if you have any additional questions, info@gws.com to answer anything that we couldn't address today. Again, thanks panelists. Thanks guys.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And thanks everybody for listening in.